Welcome to this lecture on everything you always wanted to know about cryptography but were afraid to ask. I'm Lord Egeltje. You can find it online somewhere. In this coming hour, I want to take you a bit on a journey through cryptography. What used to be top-notch cryptography, what used to be not so long ago top-notch cryptography, and where are we heading with all this quantum computer talk that's going on. For the brevity of the presentation, I made some shortcuts in certain mathematical procedures or certain system setups, so don't use this in your own projects, but for an explanation it will work very well. So first, what is cryptography? Cryptography or cryptology is the learning of cryptographic messages. And it's basically separated in two parts. We have cryptography, which is creating ciphers, creating schemes to obfuscate messages and get the original message back. And we have cryptanalysis, which is basically breaking those ciphers, those methods that we just invented to try to get to the secret message without having access to the key. And we'll see that in later on. Oh, I'll be using these four words a lot of times. Plain text, the original message, a key, some knowledge that you have to obfuscate the message. A cipher is an algorithm that will help you to garble that message using the key. And a ciphertext, which is the garbled message that you got when you applied the cipher with the key on the plain text. And our typical scenario is always in cryptography. Alice wants to send a message to Bob, and we have Eve who's trying to eavesdrop that message and who's trying to get to that secret message without having knowledge of the key. Cryptography is of all ages. In the Roman Empire, they already used cryptography, and what cryptography means or is can be a very broad, has a very broad spectrum. So for example, if you've never seen Greek, then this might seem very garbled to you. However, if you have seen some Greek writing before, then you see these might be Greek letters. Let me look up the Greek alphabet, and you find this is a very secret message. Most classical ciphers were monoalphabet substitutions, as they're called. So I have a character, an A, and I replace that with another character, for example, a C. And I take the B, and I take another one, for example, the O. And I take the C, and I take as an encrypted part the N. And I can use quite a number of those monoalphabet substitutions. However, they have some problems. Because every letter is always translated to the other character, the language properties that are in your message are also in the encrypted message. For example, in English language, we have the E, the T, the A, the O, the N, and the I. Those are the most occurring letters. And we have some groups of letters that are always together. So a U is following a Q, for example. So if I have a Q, then I know the next one most likely will be a U. Caesar cipher, Julius Caesar used this cipher to send coded messages to his generals. He shifted the alphabet by a number, so the A became the C, the B became the D, the C became the E, the D became the F. The problem is that if I know the plain text, so if I know attack at dawn, for example, the plain text message, and I know the encrypted message, then I can see how much that alphabet was shifted, and I can use that knowledge to encrypt the rest of the message as well, and probably even the messages that will arrive after that. How many keys are possible? Well, if I shift the alphabet, how many times can I shift the alphabet before it cycles back? 25 times. So I only have 25 possible keys that I have to try to see if I can decode that message. An example, ROT 13. The A becomes an M, the B becomes an N, the C becomes an O. I've written them down, and if you have the message, meet me after the toga party, then that will be translated into YQQF YQ, and you see, the Q is occurring quite a number of times. So that's probably an E or a T or an A. So I can use that to try and decode that message, even if I don't have the key. Because with a monoalphabet cipher, all the language properties are still in the coded message. So what's this message say? We don't know how much shift there was, but we can see there's two D's, there's a WW next to each other. It's also occurring here, it's also occurring here. So that could be one of those E-T-T-A-N-O-I characters. And if you try them all out, then you see N was 3, the actual cipher that Julius Caesar used. And the message was attack the castle at dawn. And all the language properties that are in the original message are also in the coded message. So they found that it was too easy to break. People got much smarter. So they thought, if I encrypt every character with its own monoalphabet substitution. So the first one will be encrypted by this substitution. The second will be encrypted with another substitution. The third will be encrypted by yet another substitution. So the language properties of a U always following a Q won't be present. This is what they used with the Pauli alphabet substitution. It's a bit vague who invented it, but it's generally described to the monk Trittenheim. And what they say, they call it nowadays a visionaire cipher, because visionaire really used it, promoted it, and made it famous. You use not just one array of characters, but you use an array, a matrix of all the characters. And you use a secret key. So not just the amount of numbers that you shifted the alphabet, but now we have a word that will tell me how much characters I need the alphabet to shift. And I use that matrix that I showed you to create the ciphertext from the plain text. So for example, attack, sentence, attack the castle at dawn. The key is secret. I write the word secret, 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 secret underneath, and I just add these characters together. So an A plus an S, if we go back to the one, the A, and then I look at the S, I get the same character, because the A is one, it doesn't shift anything. So the ciphertext is also an S. The T and the E. So I look at the E, I go all the way to the T, and I round down the character, which is just in the abbreviation. In this case, it was an X. The T and the C, I can show that the C and the T is going to be a V. And I write that down as my ciphertext. So the language properties that were in the previous cipher, so the double T, for example, attack, they don't exist anymore in this new ciphertext. So those language properties are much harder to guess. The problem with this one, this cipher, is if I have the plain text and I have the ciphertext, then I can derive the key, because the S minus the A will get me an S. The X minus the T will get me an E. So I can derive the key that was used. And in cryptography, that's not a good thing. A very famous example of polyalphabet substitution is the Enigma machine, the mythical device invented around 1915. And I assume a lot of people already know what the Enigma is. It uses rotors, and each rotor is its own monoalphabet substitution, but it shifts that ring, and it will therefore also shift that alphabet substitution for each character that you enter on the keyboard. And it has not one, but it has three of those that will shift each time you will type a character on the keyboard. So it's very, very, very complicated, and all the language properties are not available anymore in the ciphertext. Some Polish mathematicians did a lot of work just before Second World War to break that cipher, and they got a really long way, and the cryptographers in Bletchley Park, they improved on that. And they were finally able to devise a machine, the bomb, which with some guessed plain text. For example, a lot of messages from the German German started with the weather forecast. So they thought, probably the first word that we receive will be weather. And they use that to try to calculate each time to see if a combination, a reduced set of possible keys, would get them that word weather. And then they know, we found a key and we can use that key to decrypt the rest of the message and the rest of all the messages that we received that day. And it took them about 3 hours to break such a key. What do we do nowadays? Because these systems are relatively easy to crack nowadays with all the computing power that we have. So in 1994, Claude Shannon wrote some pivotal papers on the language properties of cryptographic texts, on the entropy inside a message, because a language has a lot of redundant information, and that redundant information is also available in the ciphertext, and you want to get that out. You want the ciphertext to be as random looking as possible. So he wrote that, and that really kick-started a lot of research into other algorithms. And also, there was a huge demand for new algorithms because the old algorithms were pretty much broken. We knew how to break them. We needed more and we needed better, and especially we needed faster. And there's two groups of ciphers that we now have. We have stream ciphers and we have block ciphers. Stream ciphers is I have a bit stream that's coming by and I want to encrypt that bit stream as it is moving along. And block ciphers is I have this block of bits that I want to encrypt, and it's always the same amount of bits that I want to encrypt. What a stream cipher does, it has a pseudo-random number generator on both sides, on the receiver and on the sender, and it will simply add a bit of the key to a bit of the message and send it out. That also means that if I have the plain text and if I have the ciphertext, then I can derive the key. So it's very important that a bit generator is as random as possible. And we'll see in a few slides why that is important. Because if I can predict what's going to be the next bit of the key, then I can also decode the next bit of the ciphertext, even if I don't have the proper key. How does this work? They're used still quite a lot. It's a shift register, typically. I have a number of bits, 8 in this case, and each time this register shifts, and a bit is available as a key bit. But the new bit that's being entered is dependent on a number of bits already available in that stream, or already available in that shift register. So in this case, the new bit will be an adding of bit 4 and bit 7, so the output bit, and that will be fed back into the 0 and will be shifted along. So every time I get one bit out of that register, and it will look pretty random, because at some point, yeah, this one is easy, but if you have a bit more complicated ones, like this one, this is the one from GSM, it's quite complicated to start and predict, if you only see the bitstream, how the next bit will be that you can use to decode a message. GSM uses it, Bluetooth uses it, web used it for Wi-Fi, and the MiFi Classic used it. So the MiFi Classic access card that was broken pretty nicely by Carsten Null. He took the card, he delaminated it, he looked how the chip was built, the configuration of all the transistors was, and he was able to recreate that shift register. And that can then be used to predict what key will be given by the algorithm. And you can use that to decode the MiFi Classic chip. So all the chips relying on the secrecy of the shift register were suddenly all broken, all at the same time, because you could easily predict the key. Block ciphers, so we had stream ciphers. Streams of bits are encoded with the bits of the key and then sent along, and then on the other side decoded again. Mostly used are block ciphers. I have a block of text, I have an encryption algorithm and a key that will give me ciphertext, And on the decoding side, I have ciphertext and I have a decoding algorithm, a different decoding algorithm, and the same key. Two parts, symmetric and asymmetric. I have symmetric keys, both parties, the receiver, the sender and the receiver have the same key. Des, for example, AES. And I have asymmetric, so the sender and the receiver have different keys. This is very good for sending big chunks of data very fast. This is very good for sending small bits of data. However, because the keys are different, I can prove that if you have one key, I can prove that I have the other key. So I can prove, for example, because you can decode a certain message, that it was me who sent it, because I have the encryption key, and I'm the only one who is capable of making that encrypted text that you can decode and can read. But it takes a lot more computing power. So you typically find these asymmetric keys, these asymmetric ciphers are used for transmitting keys, exchanging keys, and the bulk of the text, so all the data itself, is encrypted with symmetric keys. And we'll see that in an example. I take DES, the data encryption standard, as an example, because it's very nice way to show you all the different mechanisms that are inside the cipher, and then who those mechanisms are used inside the AES algorithm, for example. It's proposed by IBM in 1974, I was two, by the precursor of NIST, the current NIST, and two people at IBM who worked there defined a cipher, the Feistel cipher, and they proposed that to the National Bureau of Standards, and they implemented it as the data encryption standard for the American government to use. How does it work? It works on blocks of 64 bits, and it uses 84-bit round keys. What is a round key? DES itself uses 56 bits, but from that 56 bits, for each round that I run this algorithm, this cipher, it derives a key to use in each round. So it's not that every time the same key is used all the time, a new key for every subsection is used. We'll see that as well. But basically what it does, it takes 64 bits, a block of 64 bits, block cipher, it splits them in the left part and the right part. The left part will be added to the new right part and will just go through, and the right part will go through a function with a key and will then go to the left part, to the left side. So basically the 32 bits swap, and on this bit something magic happens using the key. What happens? First expanded to 48 bits, because we had that 48-bit round key. It goes through substitution boxes and it will be permutated. So first we'll expand it, the bits come in, and the bits from the left and the right side of the nibble will be also sent to the next nibble, the next four bits. So instead of just four bits, I now have six bits. Why is that important? Well, I have a 6-bit S-box, a substitution box, which basically says, take those two extra bits that you got, look them up, take the four original bits that you had, also look them up, and the new number that you will get is indicated by the number inside that box. Now, for DES, there are 8 S-boxes, and S-boxes are literally magical. So why this is a good S-box? This is actually one of the S-boxes of the DES algorithm. A lot of research goes into the good substitution, because you want to have as much random looking data at the outside. So all the changes and individual bits changing must lead to a lot of bits changing on the output. So one bit input change, a lot of bits output change. And the S-boxes are created in such a way that they do this for you. There's a bit of NSA controversy, because at some point the NSA went to the National Bureau of Standards and said, don't use this S-box, use this one. Are they doing that so they can break that S-box easier? Are they doing that to strengthen the S-box, to make it more secure? It's all shady, all spooky. It turns out they did it to make the S-box more secure in this case. So they found some weakness in the S-box that was originally proposed. And they said, if you use this one, it's going to be better. So for the DES algorithm, yes, they improved the algorithm. But it was long, hush, hush, shady, shady, shady. Final step, we do a permutation. So the first bits will be sent to the 16th bit, the second bit will send to the 7th. It's all mangled around again to also mix up the bit change that happened when you change only a few bits on the input, changing a lot of bits on the output. And then you do that 16 times. And then you have your ciphertext. So plain text, 16 times running that algorithm, and we have our ciphertext on 64 bits. And then we take the next 64 bits and we do the same thing. Very nice cipher, very nice to explain how it works, but it was proposed in 74. In 75 there was already comment that the key size was too short, that 56 bit of key was not enough. So they said, well, we just do it three times with three different keys, depending on your configuration. So instead of just 56 bit, I now have 186 bits. Okay, that's a lot longer. However, Triple DES was relatively slow. So you had to do a lot of cycles, a lot of computations, a lot of work, and they wanted something faster. So in 1979, NIST said, we need a new algorithm. So they write a contest, and people can submit their cryptographic algorithms to say, this one is awesome, this is going to be the next one for the next X years to come. They take a lot of cryptographers, they take a lot of cryptanalysts, and they try to break all the ciphers that are proposed and submitted. And then the winning algorithm that won was called Rijndael by two Belgian guys at the University of Leuven. And they had different sets. They had one for encrypting a key size of 128 bits, 192 bits, or 256 bits. And basically, so you increase the key space, and then it takes much more time to decrypt your message, to try and guess the key. The question is, which one should you use? And we'll get to that as well. How does it work? Well, we saw with DES, it takes this 64 bits, and it splits them, and it does some things to each side of them. AES uses 4x4 byte matrices. So it does a lot of the same type of operations, but then on a 4x4 matrix. We add a round key, we saw that with DES. So a round key is generated for each time you run through that cipher around. We substitute bytes using an S-box. We shift rows around. We mix columns around. We add the round key again. And then we do that an n number of times. And the number of times is determined by how big that key was that you used. So we run it 10 times if you have a 128-bit key. We do it 12 times for 192. And we have 14 times using AES 256. So if you use a bigger key, then also your algorithm becomes a bit slower. So we do that n number of times. And at the end, one more time, we substitute bytes using the S-boxes, different S-boxes than DES, by the way. We shift rows around, we add the round key again, and then we have our ciphertext. So it's different, but not that different. But then how do you use it? So you can use the same cipher each time you run it on the plaintext. If I use the electronic code book, I have a number of bits, I encrypt that, I have the output. I take the next bit of bits, I encrypt that, I have the output. I take the next number of bits, I encrypt it, I have the output. If I do that, if I have the same input, will result in the same output. It's encrypted, but it's the same for the same input that I receive. Electronic code book has some problems. So if I want to encrypt an image, for example, the famous Tux Penguin, if I use that method, well, the white will and the white text will always be encrypted to something different, but it's always the same cryptographic output. So the orange will also always be converted to the same type of orange. And so you still can recognize the penguin. So the properties of the plain text are in the electronic code book, are still also in the ciphertext. So they found another way, for example, cipher blockchaining, where I take some plain text, I encrypt that, I have the ciphertext, but I use the ciphertext, I add it to the next block of plain text, and then I encrypt it, get new ciphertext. So the output of the first ciphertext will change the input of the next time. And if I run that, then white will be white, but next time it won't be white, but it will be this white plus the white next to it. It will be a different input, which will result also in a very, very, very different output. And it will remove the language properties that are in the original text. So very important, we need to exchange keys, because the algorithm is nice, but the security of the algorithm depends on me keeping that key secret, that nobody who shouldn't have that key has access to that key. So how do I get that key to the other side? So how do I get that key that I want to keep secret to the other person that should read my message and should be able to decrypt it? Diffie-Hellman key exchange is a very nice example. I have some information. The other party has some information, and together with that information, we can together create a key, even though we don't know exactly what the other has. Very good example is using colors. We both say we take a base color, yellow. Alice is going to take red as her secret color. Bob is going to take blue as his secret color. And they add those together. So Alice will get orange, yellow plus red will be orange. Bob gets green, because yellow plus blue gets green. And they send this to each other. So Alice will send to Bob, in this case, her orange color. And Bob receives that orange color. And Bob will send his green to Alice. Then they add their own secret color again. And they will end up both with the same mixed color. Now Eve will receive that same common color, the yellow. And Eve will also see, they're exchanging green and they're exchanging orange. But if you add those all together, then you get this murky brown. So it's a different key. So Eve has no access to the key that Alice and Bob has, because for Alice, the key is orange plus the blue will get green, and in this case, this green, which consists of the secret color plus this color. So, how do you say? So deriving here will be yellow plus red plus blue is this brown, and for Bob it will be this blue plus the yellow plus the red will also be the same brown. So without exposing the blue and the red, they still derive the same key. And the people who are eavesdropping, so Eve, she doesn't have that secret color, so she has this different color of blue, which is a different key. Diffie-Hellman key exchange, lame claim to fame. I had lunch with him once, together with Jos Weijers and Bruce Schneier at Bletchley Park. He's weird. He's a very weird guy. Modern ciphers, RSA. RSA is very good to keep one bit secret, like the blue color, and give the public part, the red color, the greenish color, give that to everybody who wants to know, and use that to come to that shared key. It's invented by Rivest, Shamir, and Alderman in 1977. There was somebody who was first, but he worked at GCHQ, and everything is classified at GCHQ. So he was first, but he couldn't publish because it was all secret. So if you want to work for a secret service, you get some very awesome mathematics to work with, but you can't share your research. And it depends on the complexity of calculating the prime numbers of one very, 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 very big number. It's easy to calculate it one way, and it's very hard to calculate it the other way. I can go in the mathematical part. I'll skip that for now, and I'll come back if I have some time left at the end. So there's some things that are Euler. We saw the colors. Let me first skip to demo. Elliptic curves. Because RSA is very, it's a very elegant way of sharing your keys, but it's also very, very, very slow. And you can only send numbers that are smaller than the largest secret number that you choose. So we had to find another way of being very secure, but also very fast. And what people now came up with is elliptic curves. You walk around an elliptic curve. It has x squared equals to x to the third, well, you see, x to the third plus ax plus b. That's your generic shape of such a curve. You have a few parameters, like a and b. You can publish those so that you can share the curve that you're using to generate the key. But you're not going to share how many times you walk that curve. Now, what do I need with walk the curve? I have a generator. I start somewhere. And I say, look, I have a very nice curve. It has this shape. I start at this point. And then I'm going to multiply that point by itself. And multiplying on this graph, what does it mean? I take the line that is the raaklijn, not perpendicular, but tangent. Tangent to this curve. It will intersect the graph on another point. I mirror that in the x-axis, and that's my second point. Then I take a line that's going to intersect g, and it will intersect that new point, 2g, and it will intersect always on another point, 3g. I flip that around, and this is my 3g point. And I can then go, I draw a line through here on the 3g, it will intersect somewhere here, I flip it around, this is going to be 4g. And then I go 5G, 6G, 7G, 8G. I do that a number of times. How many times I did that, so I can publish, I have this point. I want to this point. How many times I did that, I keep to myself. That's a secret. There should be a demo. Yes. So we have the curve, we have the generator, and we have this point that I created when I walked around this curve n number of times, and then n is very, 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 very long. So what do Alice and Bob do? They both generate that point. So Bob is going to walk that curve 3 times, and Alice is going to walk that curve 4 times, and they both come up at a certain point. And they share that point with each other. What Alice then does is she adds her number. Alice walked it 3 times, so she adds it to the 4 times that Bob walked the curve, coming to 7. Bob is taking the number that Alice gave him, which is 3, adds his own number, 4, and also comes to that point, 7. So this the point that they eventually end up on that curve is the same for both parties, even though they didn't share how many times they walked that curve before. Eve has to calculate. Eve has 2 points. But she doesn't know how many times they have to walk that curve, so Eve doesn't know how to end up in the point that Bob and Alice want to agree. And that point can represent a key that you can then use in your block cipher to encrypt lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of data. So it's a very elegant way to come together to the same key without sharing properties of that individual set. Very nice. NIST curve. There's a number of groups that are created curves for to use with this algorithm. So NIST has a number of curves defined, also with different key sizes. The Certicom Group has some defined. The ECC brain pool is a set of curves that are with all different properties. And if you look at, for example, OpenSSL and all the algorithms that they support, you'll find some are SEC P256, for example. Other are ECC brain pool with a key size. Some of them are curve 255-19. That's one by Daniel Bernstein. He said, I don't trust that government stuff too much. So he did all calculations. He's a very well-known cryptographer, together with Tanja Lange in Eindhoven. They come up with a different curve, a different type of curve. And they used a finite field of 252 to the power of 255 minus 19. And that's where you find the 255-19 name of that curve. Where I said that with stream ciphers, with it's very important that the key appears as random as possible. So we have pseudo-random number generators. They look very random, but they're not that random because we have to be able to generate them both at the same time. RSA used the dual EC deterministic random bit generator. And it was found that the NSA had some influence in the quality of that random number generator. So they degraded it a bit, so it was easier for them to predict how the key would look like if that was used. And that was quite a stink in about 10 years ago. So they did with DES some good stuff in improving the algorithm, and with this part they did some stuff to weaken the algorithm. Not so nice. Yeah, I also had dinner with him. I don't use Bitcoin, but everybody who uses Bitcoin uses elliptic curve cryptography. Everything is signed using elliptic curve cryptography, using a different curve in this case. Nobody was using that one until we started using Bitcoin, and now everybody is using that curve. It has some parameters, but you see the shape is still the same, and the mechanism is still the same. Everybody knows the shape. Everybody knows we start at a certain point, for example here, and everybody can start calculate, walk that curve, but keep the number of times that they walked that curve, keep that secret, and that's going to be the private key of your Bitcoin wallet. So the whole world is already using elliptic curve cryptography. But now, future ciphers. Quantum computing was invented quite some time already, by the way. And there was this magic thing called Shor's algorithm. And then we need post-quantum cryptography. There's actually a talk right after mine, I think in Leonardo, by Oscar Kuro, on what the Dutch government is doing on post-quantum cryptography, what infrastructure they're setting up. But what is it? Is it going to be a doom? Yes and no. Yes. An example. RSA relies on the difficulty of having this very, very big number and splitting it into two prime numbers that were multiplied to come to this very big, big number. Well, we take a very big number, for example, 55. So this as an example. And the question is, which two prime numbers were used to multiply to get to 55? And this is very hard for really, 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 really long numbers. We pick a number so that it has no factors in common with the 55. So there's no number that I can define the number G that I'm going to pick that it shares with 55. So 55, it's 5 and 11, okay? So I have to pick another number then that's divisible by 5 or divisible by 11. So I can't take 10, but I can't take, for example, 4. And at some point, there will be a point that this number that I picked randomly to the power r is a number of times 55 plus 1. There's always going to be a point where that's valid. I can show you why. But so I take 4 and I'm just going to calculate. And I find g to the power of r is 4 divided by 55. It doesn't fit, but I have 4 remaining. I take it by 2, 16. 64 divided by 55 is 1, and I keep 9. 4 to the power of 4, 256, I can divide it by 55 is 4, and I have a remainder of 36. Well, I can calculate all the remainders, and we see, 4 to the power of 10 divided by 55 is 19,065, and I have a remainder of 1. Aha. So g to the power of 10, 4 to the power of 10, will fit that function of being a number of times 19,000 something times n, 55 plus 1. I'm not interested in this how many times, I'm interested in that 1. R is 10, and then we can use that to rewrite the formula. We get the 1 to the other side, so g to the power of r minus 1 equals a number of times n, and I can split that into g half times r plus 1 times g to the half r minus 1 is equal to a number of times n. And again, I'm not interested in how many number of times, I was interested in that 1. Well, we can calculate. G I picked was 4, I found r was 10, the half of 10 is 5, so 4 to the power of 5 plus 1 is 125, and 4 to the power of 5 minus 1 is 123, and then I looked what number is the biggest common divisor of those numbers, and you find 55 can be divided by 5, but 125 can also be divided by 5. 123 can be divided by 11, 55 can also be divided by 11, and there I have my two prime factors. And I can use Euclid algorithm very efficiently to find which is the largest number that both are divisible through. So doing this trick of trying to find how many times I need to raise this random number to the power will result in a number of times n plus 1, in this case 10. Why is that interesting? It's periodic. So if I take r to the 11th, this will fit a number of times in the calculation and have a remainder of 4. That's similar as I did with 1. The same with 12, it's similar as I did with 2. So this 10 is a periodic cycle that will repeat. If I would do that for 21, 23, 23, 24, I would find the same numbers. So that m is different, so the number of times I have to multiply n is going to be different, but I don't care. I'm interested in this 1. And if you plot that, then you see a very nice frequency occurring. And this periodic sequence, I can use Fourier transforms to find that periodicity. Now, I can find out how often that repeats itself. And this is where Shor's algorithm is very nice, because this is what that quantum computer is really good at. It's really good at finding where is this period. Where is this period? Where is this finding? And if I know where this period is, then I can take that randomly picked number and I can use that in that period that was found by the quantum computer to quickly find which prime numbers were used to come to that really, really big number that is used in the RSA. So that's the reason why quantum computers will break RSA. They're really efficient using this periodic behavior of that function to find the original prime numbers that were used in RSA. So factoring those prime numbers, that's going to be easy and very, very fast. So what are a lot of government agencies doing? They just record everything. Because if you have the key exchange and you record that, then you can use that later on, if you have that quantum computer, to crack that really, really long number, find which prime numbers were used, and then decode all the messages that come after that, because you have access to the key. So you store now in the hope that in the future they will have a quantum computer, and perhaps they already have, I don't know, and they can decrypt the key exchange, find the key, and use that to decode the whole message. So they can they crack it now? Don't know, but they are storing it now. That's it requires a certain number of qubits. So I have a pretty large, I need a pretty large quantum computer to perform this trick on really large RSA numbers. So if I now have an RSA, 2048 bit key, I need a pretty substantial quantum computer to break that. But the crossover point, so the point where the amount of qubits that are available versus the amount of bits that I use for my key, people smarter than me expect that that will be somewhere in 2035. So that at 2035, there will be publicly available quantum computers that are capable of breaking the RSA 2048 bit key. Symmetrical ciphers are still fine-ish. A quantum computer is also really fast. So the time it takes now, the millions of years that it will take to brute force a symmetric key will roughly be halved, but still the half of millions and millions of years is still millions of years. So cool, even with a quantum computer. But for this key exchange part, quantum computers really shine. So we need something new. NIST again made a competition, and they said we want to have cryptography that quantum computers cannot break. Nice challenge. On the 5th of July 2022, four algorithms were chosen. They had quite a lot of submissions, and they were all tested. From is this potentially quantum computer safe? Is it breakable by any other means? Because some very good quantum resistant algorithms were easy to break using just normal math. So, well, that's not helpful. But three of the four that are in the finals now, and the people are banging on them, and they try to break them, doing all kinds of cryptanalysis on them. Three of the four that are selected use lattice cryptography. And that's based on finding the shortest vector. How does that work? Again, beautifully. Bob wants to send a key to Alice, or Alice wants to send a key to Bob. Bob generates a lattice, and that is basically a field of points. And it's a field of points that's generated by a number of vectors. I've taken two in this example, because it's a nice two-day space here. Bob has two vectors, one going up and one going slightly to the right, lower right. And that generates this field of dots. So all these points can be reached using a multiple of these two vectors. But Bob also calculates two very hard vectors. Those two vectors still generate the same field of dots, the same dots, but we'll see that it's much harder to use them in calculations. So Bob has an easy set of vectors to create that field and to go through that field. And he also calculates a very hard set of vectors. And he publishes that very hard set of vectors. Keep in mind, this is two dimension. You do this in 1,000 plus dimensions. So it's pretty complicated. Alice wants to send a key to Bob. Alice picks a point which is close, but not on one of those points. So Alice has the complex vectors, but using those complex vectors, those difficult vectors, you can still generate that same lattice, that same field of all the dots. And then Alice says, I'm going to pick this point, and that's close to a certain dot. For Bob, it's easy. You can just go, oh, okay, that point. Which point is closest to that dot? Okay, then I need to go four up, one to the right, and then I'm at the point which is closest to that dot. So he knows four up, one right, and that's going to be the key. Eve just received the two very hard vectors, and Eve can generate that same lattice field, but she can generate the field, but she doesn't know which of the points is closest to this red dot. And that's why Alice, when she sent it over to Bob, she didn't take a point on a dot, but she took a point close to a dot. And the challenge is find the dot in the matrix, in the lattice, which is closest to that point. And Eve has that point, but Eve has to go, I need to go minus this one, and then I need a little bit up, so I need one time, then I'm somewhere here, and then... So Eve has to do a lot of calculations to find all the dots that are close to that point, and then find which dot is closest. And remember, this is in two dimensions. if you do this lattice-based, you do it in 1,000+ dimensions. So a step in one direction could be a totally wrong step for all the other dimensions. And this is also for quantum computing very, very hard to decode. So where they're very quick in getting those prime numbers, finding those prime numbers, quantum computers are not good in solving this problem. And this is a very promising algorithm that's going to be used for quantum safe key exchange, that you cannot use quantum computing to quickly find your way to the key that's going to be shared. Heaven. So this was in 55 minutes my introduction. Are there questions? Yes, there is a reason for that. Check. So we have there's two ways of generating a finite field where the keys can exist, and it's under the hood is more complicated than just this explanation. So the points that you use in the elliptic curve are defined on a finite field, and that field is generated by, for example, a prime number. And there's a nice trick that if you use Mersenne primes, which is basically 2^(a′-1) is again a prime. And you can use some smart mathematical tricks to quickly calculate the key. So that's why you see 251, weird number. But it's a Mersenne prime, so you can use that to use some trapdoors in mathematics to quickly come at the key. Yeah.
Thank you. I make a CTF every year, and I've been wanting to do one based on AES with a bad S-box. What's a good way to make a bad S-box?
A good way to make a bad S-box is to have not much change in the output depending on the input. So the S-box is used to substitute bytes and basically to see, okay, if I change one bit on the input, then roughly half of the output bits should change. If it doesn't do that, that's bad. Where should I enroll? Other questions? Anyone interested in the mathematics behind RSA? I'll make the slides available, that's no problem. So you can, if you want to, you can easily read the and do all the calculations for yourself. I think it's beautiful. Do all the calculations for equals one. But for now, it might be a bit much to go through. I can show you the example. That's perhaps nice as a.
Oh, sorry. Export restriction on RSA?
No. Yeah, there are some parts where they try to use export restrictions to limit access to the, sorry, the US could use it, but nobody else could use it, but it's in this global world, then, and for now, that there's also no, I've got an 8K RSA key, because you can. It's not practical. It's totally not practical, but you can. Other questions? Key setup, very quickly through RSA. So Bob chooses two prime numbers, P and Q, and he calculates the product, so P times Q, and he also calculates phi, which is P minus 1 times Q minus 1. And we use that for a trapdoor later on. He takes an encryption exponent that's relative prime, so it has no shared number that you can divide both numbers through, relative to phi. And he calculates a decryption exponent so that E times D equals 1 times a number of times phi. And I'm not interested in phi, in the number of times, but I'm interested in that one. I publish E, I publish N, and I keep D secret. So everybody can use this to encrypt stuff, but nobody can decrypt. I keep the decryption for me as a secret. Alice has a secret message M, and she calculates M, the subscript fell down, M to the power of E. So she received E from Bob and the N, and she calculates M to the power of E, and it equals C times a number of times N. I'm not interested in how many times, but and she passes this C to Bob. So Alice and Bob both can calculate this one, Eve can also calculate that one. Bob receives C, gaat weer iets mis met de superscript, and Bob calculates the message that I received to the power of the decryption key, and it equals to the message modulus, so a number of times N. I'm not interested in how many times. And you find M. Well, basically where it comes down to that both raise the message to the power of their exponent, and if you raise an exponent to an exponent, you can multiply the exponents, and this is what you use to that both keep their secret bit secret, but still can come to the same solution. Eve receives C, she knows N, she knows E, she doesn't know D, so she has to solve that something to the power of E equals to C modulus times a number of times N. And this is a very, 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 very complex thing to do in normal computing. So for example, take the eth root of the message. If you don't use the modulus, it's a very nice curve, and you can just, oh, there it is. So if I see a point, then I can derive, oh, it must be here. But if I take the modular root, so if I multiply it at times that number n, the dots are all over the place, and I cannot predict where I will end up. That's the tricky part, and that makes it secure. Two prime numbers, P and Q, 17, 37, 42 unfortunately is not a prime number. N is the product, so 629. Phi is P minus 1 times Q minus 1 equals 576. E, pick one, 41. It's a prime number, nice. It's a prime number, so it has no shared numbers that is divisible by N, this number that I choose, and the number N. So this is fine. And I calculate, because I picked this one, then I have to calculate this number, so that 41 times this number equals 1 times a number of times N. Not interested in how many times, interested in that one. Alice has a secret message, 55. Plain text, she knows N, she knows E. So what she does, she calculates 55 to the power of 41, modulo that number N, and you receive 98. And she sends 89 to Bob. So Bob receives 89. He takes 89 to the power of his decryption number, is a huge number. He divides that a number of times through that number N, 629, I don't care how often, and I got a remainder of 55. And 55 was a secret message. And Eve, she has the secret message, 89. She has the N, the 629. She has E, because Bob told everybody E is going to be 41, but she doesn't know. She has to calculate something to the power of 41 equals the ciphertext modulus dot. And that's really, 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 really difficult to do. And if you want to read it, all the proof is here. So I'll share the slide, yeah. I'll share the slides, and if you want to reread and recalculate this in your own time, you're totally free to do it. I'll be walking around. If you have any other questions, then please let me know. Yep. Oh.